The Secret Doctrine by Elena Petrovna Blavatsky, a facsimile of the original edition of 1888, printed by the Cunningham Press, Alhambra, California. Book 2, Part 1, Anthropogenesis. Stanzas translated with commentaries from the Secret Book of John.
Stanza 7, from the semi-divine down to the first human races, in which the higher creators reject in their pride the forms evolved by the sons of yoga. And in verse 25, they will not incarnate in the early eggborn. And 26, they select the later androgynes. And 27, the first man endowed with mind. This stanza contains in itself the whole key to the mysteries of evil, the so-called fall of the angels, and the many problems that have puzzled the brains of the philosophers from the time that the memory of man began. It solves the secret of the subsequent inequalities of intellectual capacity, of birth or social position, and gives a logical explanation to the incomprehensible karmic course throughout the aeons which followed. The best explanation which can be given in view of the difficulties of the subject shall now be attempted. Verse 24. The sons of wisdom, the sons of night, issued from the bud of Brahma when it became night, ready for rebirth, came down. They saw the intellectually vile forms of the first third, still senseless race. Up to the fourth round, and even to the later part of the third race in this round, man, if the ever-changing forms that clothed the monads during the first three rounds and the first two and a half races of the present one can be given that misleading name, is so far only an animal intellectually. It is only in the actual midway round that he develops in himself entirely the fourth principle as a fit vehicle for the fifth. But Manas will be relatively fully developed only in the following round, when it will have an opportunity of becoming entirely divine until the end of the rounds. As Christian Schütgen says in Ore Hebraica, etc., the first terrestrial Adam had only the breath of life, nephesh, but not the living soul. Verse 24 continued. We can choose, said the lords. We have wisdom. Some entered the chayas. Some projected a spark. Some deferred till the fourth race. From their own essence they filled, intensified, the karma, the vehicle of desire. Those who received but a spark remained destitute of higher knowledge. The spark burnt low. Here the inferior races, of which there are still some analogies left, as the Australians, now fast dying out, and some African and Oceanic tribes are meant. They were not ready signifies that the karmic development of these monads had not yet fitted them to occupy the forms of men destined for incarnation in high intellectual races, but this is explained later on. Verse 24 continued. The third remained mindless. Their jivas, monads, were not ready. These were set apart among the seven primitive human species. They became the narrow-headed. The third were ready. In these shall we dwell, said the lords of the flame and of the dark wisdom. The Zohar speaks of black fire, which is absolute light wisdom. To those who, prompted by old theological prejudice, may say, but the Asuras are the rebel devas, the opponents of the gods, hence devils and the spirits of evil, it is answered. Esoteric philosophy admits neither good nor evil per se, as existing independently in nature. The cause for both is found, as regards the cosmos, in the necessity of contraries or contrasts, and with respect to man in his human nature, his ignorance and passions. There is no devil or the utterly depraved, as there are no angels absolutely perfect, though there may be spirits of light and of darkness. Thus Lucifer, the spirit of intellectual enlightenment and freedom of thought, is metaphorically the guiding beacon which helps man to find his way through the rocks and sandbanks of life, for Lucifer is the Logos in his highest and the adversary in his lowest aspect, both of which are reflected in our ego. Lactantius, speaking of the nature of Christ, makes the Logos, the Word, the firstborn brother of Satan, the first of all creatures. The Vishnu Purana describes these primeval creatures, the Arvaksurota, with crooked digestive canals. They were endowed with inward manifestations, but mutually in ignorance about their kind and nature. The 28 kinds of bada, or imperfections, do not apply, as Wilson thought, to the animals now known and specified by him, for these did not exist in those geological periods. Note, see Book 1, Chapter 5, page 71, end of note. This is quite plain in the said work, in which the first created on this globe are the fivefold immovable creation, minerals and vegetables. Then come those fabulous animals, Tiryaksrota, the monsters of the abyss slain by the lords, see stanzas 2 and 3. Then the Urdhvasrotas, the happy celestial beings which feed on ambrosia. Then lastly, the Arvaksrotas, human beings, Brahma's seventh creation, so-called. But these, quote, creations, unquote, including the latter, did not occur on this globe, wherever else they may have taken place. It is not Brahma who creates things and men on this earth, but the chief and lord of the Prajapati, the lords of being and terrestrial creation. Note, see Vishnu Purana, Book 1, Chapter 15, Volume 2, end of note. Obeying the command of Brahma, Daksha, the synthesis or the aggregate of the terrestrial creators and progenitors, Pitris included, made superior and inferior, Vara and Avara, things, referring to Putra, progeny, and bipeds and quadrupeds, and subsequently, by his will, the sons of will and yoga made females, that is, separated the androgynes. Here again, we have bipeds or men created before the quadrupeds, as in the esoteric teachings. Vira Supra and stanza 12, as explained. Since, in the exoteric accounts, the Asuras are the first beings created from the body of night, while the Pitris issue from that of twilight, the gods being placed by Parasara in Vishnu Purana between the two, and shown to evolve from the body of the day, it is easy to discover a determined purpose to veil the order of creation. Man is the Aravaksrota, coming from the body of the dawn, and elsewhere man is again referred to when the creator of the world, Brahma, is shown creating fierce beings, denominated Buddhas and eaters of flesh, or as the text has it, fiends frightful from being monkey-coloured and carnivorous. Note, from the same source of Vishnu Purana, Book 1, Chapter 5, end of note. Whereas the Rakshas are generally translated by evil spirits and the enemies of the gods, which identifies them with the Asuras. In the Ramayana, when Hanuman is reconnoitering the enemy in Lanka, he finds there Rakshasas, some hideous, while some were beautiful to look upon, and in Vishnu Purana, there is direct reference to their becoming the saviors of humanity or of Brahma. The allegory is very ingenious. Great intellect and too much knowledge are a two-edged weapon in life, and instruments for evil as well as for good. When combined with selfishness, they will make of the whole of humanity a footstool for the evolution of him who possesses them, and a means for the attainment of his objects. While applied to altruistic humanitarian purposes, they may become the means of the salvation of many. At all events, the absence of self-consciousness and intellect will make a man an idiot, a brute in human form. Brahma is Mahat, the universal mind, hence the two selfish among the Rakshasas, showing the desire to become possessed of it all, to devour Mahat. The allegory is transparent. At any rate, esoteric philosophy identifies the pre-Brahmanical Asuras, Rudras, Rakshasas, and all the adversaries of the gods in the allegories with the egos which, by incarnating in the still witless man of the third race, made him consciously immortal. Note on Rudras, whom Manu calls our paternal grandfathers, 3.284. The Rudras are the seven manifestations of Rudra Shiva, the destroying god, and also the grand yogi and ascetic, end of note. They are then, during the cycle of incarnations, the true dual logos, the conflicting and two-faced divine principle in man. The commentary that follows, and the next stanzas may, no doubt, throw more light on this very difficult tenet, but the writer does not feel competent to give it out fully. of the succession of races, however, they say, first come the self-existent on this earth. They are the spiritual lives projected by the absolute will and law at the dawn of every rebirth of the worlds. These lives are the divine Sishta, the seed manus, or the Prajapati and the Pitris. From these proceed, 1. The first race, the self-born, which are the astral shadows of their progenitors. See section 2 and subsection 1 commentary. The body was devoid of all understanding, mind, intelligence, and will. The inner being, the higher self or monad, though within the earthly frame, was unconnected with it. The link, the manas, was not there as yet. 2. From the first rays emanated the second, called the sweat-born, and the boneless. Note, to speak of life as having arisen, and of the human race as having originated, in this absurdly unscientific way in the face of the modern pedigrees of man, is to cause instantaneous annihilation. The esoteric doctrine risks the danger nevertheless, and even goes so far as to ask the impartial reader to compare the above hypothesis, if it is one, with Haeckel's theory, now fast becoming an axiom with science, which is quoted verbatim. Quote, how did life, the living world of organisms, arise? And secondly, the special question, how did the human race originate? The first of these two inquiries, that as to the first appearance of living beings, can only be decided empirically, within brackets double exclamation mark, by proof of the so-called archebiosis, or equivocal generation, or the spontaneous production of organisms of the simplest conceivable kind. Such are the monera, protogenes, protoamoeba, etc., exceedingly simple microscopic masses of protoplasm without structure or organization which take a nutriment and reproduce themselves by division. Such a moneron as that primordial organism discovered by the renowned English zoologist Huxley and named Bathybius haeckeli appears as a continuous thick protoplasmic covering at the greatest depths of the ocean between 3,000 and 30,000 feet. It is true that the first appearance of such monera has not up to the present moment been actually observed. But there is nothing intrinsically improbable in such an evolution. From the Pedigree of Man, Aveling's translation, page 33. The Bathybius protoplasm, having recently turned out to be no organic substance at all, there remains little to be said. Nor, after reading this, does one need to consume further time in refuting the further assertion that, quote, in that case man also has, beyond a doubt, to the minds of Haeckel and his like, arisen from the lower mammalia, apes and the earlier simian creatures, the still earlier marsupialia, amphibia, pieces, by progressive transformations, or produced by a series of natural forces working blindly, without aim, without design. Unquote, from page 36. The above-quoted passage bears its criticism on its own face. Science is made to teach that which up to the present time has never been actually observed. She is made to deny the phenomenon of an intelligent nature and a vital force independent of form and matter, and to find it more scientific to teach the miraculous performance of natural forces working blindly without aim or design. If so, then we are led to think that the physico-mechanical forces of the brains of certain eminent scientists are leading them on as blindly to sacrifice logic and common sense on the altar of mutual admiration. Why should the protoplasmic moneron producing the first living creature through self-division be held as a very scientific hypothesis and an ethereal pre-human race generating the primeval man in the same fashion be tabooed as unscientific superstition? Or has materialism obtained a sole monopoly in science? End of note. This is the second root race endowed by the preservers, Rakshasas, and the incarnating gods, Asuras and the Kumaras, with the first primitive and weak spark, the germ of intelligence, and from these in turn proceeds. 3. The third root race, the twofold, androgynes. The first races hereof are shells, till the last is inhabited, that is, informed by the Dhyanis. Note on the Rakshasas. The Rakshasas, regarded in Indian popular theology as demons, are called the preservers beyond the Himalayas. This double and contradictory meaning has its origin in a philosophical allegory, which is variously rendered in the Puranas. It is stated that when Brahma created the demons, Yakshas, from Yaksh, to eat, and the Rakshasas, both of which kinds of demons, as soon as born, wished to devour their creator, those among them that called out, "Not so, oh, let him be saved, preserved," were named Rakshasas. See Vishnu Purana, Book 1, Chapter 5. The Bhagavata Purana, 3:20, 19-21, renders the allegory differently. Brahma transformed himself into night, or ignorance, invested with a body, upon which the Yakshas and Rakshasas seized, exclaiming, "Do not spare it, devour it." Brahma then cried out, "Do not devour me, spare me." This has an inner meaning, of course. The body of night is the darkness of ignorance, and it is the darkness of silence and secrecy. Now the Rakshasas are shown in almost every case to be yogis, pious sadhus and initiates, a rather unusual occupation for demons. The meaning, then, is that while we have power to dispel the darkness of ignorance, devour it, we have to preserve the sacred truth from profanation. Brahma is for the Brahmins alone, says that proud caste. The moral of the fable is evident. End of note. Again, as described in the commentary, the very earliest of that race were the sons of passive yoga. Note. The gradual evolution of man in the secret doctrine shows that all the later, to the profane the earliest, races have their physical origin in the early fourth race. But it is the sub-race which preceded the one that separated sexually that is to be regarded as the spiritual ancestors of our present generations, and especially of the Eastern Aryan races. Weber's idea that the Indo-Germanic race preceded the Aryan Vedic race is, to the occultist, grotesque to the last degree. End of note. Further on the sons of passive yoga, they issued from the second Manushyas, human race, and became oviparous. The emanations that came out of their bodies during the seasons of procreation were ovulary, the small spheroidal nuclei, developing into a large, soft, egg-like vehicle, gradually hardened when, after a period of gestation, it broke and the young human animal issued from it unaided, as the foals do in our race. This must seem to the reader ludicrously absurd. Nevertheless, it is strictly on the lines of evolutionary analogy, which science perceives in the development of the living animal species. First the monoron-like procreation by self-division, Wieder Heckel. Then, after a few stages, the oviparous, as in the case of the reptiles, which are followed by the birds. Then, finally, the mammals with their ovoviviparous modes of producing their young ones. If the term ovoviviparous is applied to some fish and reptiles which hatch their eggs within their bodies, why should it not be applied to female mammalians, including women? The ovula, in which, after impregnation, the development of the fetus takes place, is an egg. At all events, this conception is more philosophical than that of Eve, with the suddenly created placenta giving birth to Cain because of the apple, when even the marsupial, the earliest of mammals, is not placental yet. Moreover, the progressive order of the methods of reproduction, as unveiled by science, is a brilliant confirmation of esoteric ethnology. It is only necessary to tabulate the data in order to prove our assertion. Confer especially Schmidt's Doctrine of Descent and Darwinism, page 39 in sequence, and Lange's A Modern Zoroastrian, pages 102-111. 1. Fission. A. As seen in the division of the homogeneous speck or protoplasm, known as monoron or amoeba, into two. B. As seen in the division of the nucleated cell in which the cell nucleus splits into two subnuclei, which either develop within the original cell wall or burst it and multiply outside as independent entities. Compare the first root rays. 2. Budding. A small portion of the parent structure swells out at the surface and finally parts company, growing to the size of an original organism, for example, many vegetables, the sea anemone, etc. Compare the second root race. Note, every process of healing and cicatrization in the higher animal groups, even in the case of reproduction of mutilated limbs with the amphibians, is affected by fission and gemmation of the elementary morphological elements. End of note. 3. Spores, a single cell thrown off by the parent organism, which develops into a multicellular organism reproducing the features of the latter, for example, bacteria and mosses. 4. Intermediate hermaphroditism, male and female organs inhering in the same individual, for example, the majority of plants, worms, and snails, etc., allied to budding. Compare second and early third root races. 5. True sexual union. Confer later third root race. We now come to an important point with regard to the double evolution of the human race. The sons of wisdom, or the spiritual Dianis, had become intellectual through their contact with matter because they had already reached, during previous cycles of incarnation, that degree of intellect which enabled them to become independent and self-conscious entities on this plane of matter. They were reborn only by reason of karmic effects. They entered those who were ready and became the arhats, or sages, alluded to above. This needs explanation. It does not mean that the monads entered forms in which other monads already were. They were essences, intelligences, and conscious spirits, entities seeking to become still more conscious by uniting with a more developed matter. Their essence was too pure to be distinct from the universal essence, but their eggs, or manas, since they are called Manashaputra, born of Mahat, or Brahma, had to pass through earthly human experiences to become all-wise and be able to start on the returning ascending cycle. The monads are not discrete principles, limited or conditioned, but rays from that one universal absolute principle. The entrance into a dark room through the same aperture of one ray of sunlight following another will not constitute two rays, but one ray intensified. It is not in the course of natural law that man should become a perfect septenary being before the seventh race in the seventh round. Yet he has all these principles latent in him from his birth. Nor is it part of the evolutionary law that the fifth principle, manas, should receive its complete development before the fifth round. All such prematurely developed intellects on the spiritual plane in our race are abnormal. They are those whom we call the fifth rounders. Even in the coming seventh race, at the close of this fourth round, while our four lower principles will be fully developed, that of manas will be only proportionally so. This limitation, however, refers solely to the spiritual development. The intellectual on the physical plane was reached during the fourth root race. Thus, those who were half ready, who received but a spark, constitute the average humanity which has to acquire its intellectuality during the present manvantaric evolution, after which they will be ready in the next for the full reception of the sons of wisdom. While those which were not ready at all, the latest monads, which had hardly evolved from their last transitional and lower animal forms at the close of the third round, remained the narrow-brained of the stanza. This explains the otherwise unaccountable degrees of intellectuality among the various races of men, the savage Bushman and the European even now. Those tribes of savages whose reasoning powers are very little above the level of the animals are not the unjustly disinherited or the unfavored, as some may think, nothing of the kind. They are simply those latest arrivals among the human monads which were not ready, which have to evolve during the present round, as on the three remaining globes, hence on four different planes of being, so as to arrive at the level of the average class when they reach the fifth round. One remark may prove useful as food for thought to the student in this connection. The monads of the lowest specimens of humanity, the narrow-brained, savage South Sea Islander, the African, the Australian, had no karma to work out when first born as men, as their more favored breed in intelligence had. The former are spinning out karma only now. The latter are burdened with past, present, and future karma. In this respect, the poor savage is more fortunate than the greatest genius of civilized countries. Let us pause before giving any more such strange teachings. Let us try and find out how far any ancient scriptures, and even science, permit the possibility of, or even distinctly corroborate, such wild notions as are found in our anthropogenesis. Recapitulating that which has been said, we find that the secret doctrine claims for man 1. A polygenetic origin. 2. A variety of modes of procreation before humanity fell into the ordinary method of generation. 3. That the evolution of animals, of the mammalians at any rate, follows that of man instead of preceding it. And this is diametrically opposed to the now generally accepted theories of evolution and the descent of man from an animal ancestor. Note on the narrow-brained. The term here means neither the dolichocephalic nor the brachiocephalic, nor yet skulls of a smaller volume, but simply brains devoid of intellect generally, the theory which would judge of the intellectual capacity of a man according to his cranial capacity seems absurdly logical to one who has studied the subject. The skulls of the Stone period, as well as those of African races, Bushmen included, show that the first are above rather than below the average of the brain capacity of the modern man, and the skulls of the last are on the whole, as in the case of Papuans and Polynesians generally, larger by 1 cubic inch than that of the average Frenchman. Again, the cranial capacity of the Parisian of today represents an average of 1,437 cubic centimeters compared to 1,523 of the Auvernet. End of note. Let us begin to case what is cases, examine first of all the chances for the polygenetic theory among the men of science. Now the majority of the Darwinian evolutionists incline to a polygenetic explanation of the origin of races. On this particular question, however, scientists are, as in many other cases, at sixes and sevens. They agree to disagree. Does man descend from one single couple or from several groups? Monogenism or polygenism? As far as one can venture to pronounce on what, in the absence of witnesses, within brackets question mark, will never be known, within brackets question mark, the second hypothesis is far the most probable. Note, A. Lefebvre, Philosophy, page 498, end of note. Abel Hoverlack, in his Science of Language, comes to a similar conclusion, arguing from the evidence available to a linguistic inquirer. In an address delivered before the British Association, Professor W. H. Flower remarked on this question, quote, "The view which appears best to accord with what is now known of the character and distribution of the races of man is a modification of the monogenistic hypothesis," within brackets exclamation mark. Without entering into the difficult question of the method of man's first appearance upon the world, we must assume for it a vast antiquity, at all events as measured by any historical standard. If we had any approach to a complete paleontological record, the history of man could be reconstructed, but nothing of the kind is forthcoming." Unquote. Such an admission must be regarded as fatal to the dogmatism of the physical evolutionists, and as opening a wide margin to occult speculations. The opponents of the Darwinian theory were and still remain polygenists. Such intellectual giants as John Crawford and James Hunt discussed the problem and favored polygenesis, and in their day there was a far stronger feeling in favor of than against this theory. It is only in 1864 that Darwinians began to be wedded to the theory of unity, of which Monsieur Huxley and Lubbock became the first coryphée. As regards that other question of the priority of man to the animals in the order of evolution, the answer is promptly given. If man is really the microcosm of the macrocosm, then the teaching has nothing so very impossible in it, and is but logical. For man becomes that macrocosm for the three lower kingdoms under him. Arguing from a physical standpoint, all the lower kingdoms, save the mineral, which is light itself, crystallized and immetallized, from plants to the creatures which preceded the first mammalians, have all been consolidated in their physical structures by means of the cast-off dust of those minerals, and the refuse of the human matter, whether from living or dead bodies, on which they fed and which gave them their outer bodies. In his turn, man grew more physical by reabsorbing into his system that which he had given out, and which became transformed in the living animal crucibles through which it had passed, owing to nature's alchemical transmutations. There were animals in those days of which our modern naturalists have never dreamed, and the stronger became physical material man, the giants of those times, the more powerful were his emanations. Once that androgyne humanity, separated into sexes, transformed by nature into childbearing engines, it ceased to procreate its like through drops of vital energy oozing out of the body. But while man was still ignorant of his procreative powers on the human plane, before his fall, as a believer in Adam would say, all this vital energy scattered far and wide from him was used by nature for the production of the first mammal-animal forms. Evolution is an eternal cycle of becoming, we are taught, and nature never leaves an atom unused. Moreover, from the beginning of the round, all in nature tends to become man. All the impulses of the dual centripetal and centrifugal force are directed towards one point, man. The progress in the succession of beings, says Agassiz, consists in increasing similarity of the living fauna and among the vertebrates especially, and the increasing resemblance to man. Man is the end towards which all animal creation has tended from the first appearance of the first Paleozoic fishes. Note, Principles of Zoology, page 206. End of note. Just so, but the Paleozoic fishes, being at the lower curve of the arc of the evolution of forms, this round began with the astral man, the reflection of the Giancochans called the Builders. Man is the Alpha and the Omega of objective creation. As said in Isis Unveil, all things had their origin in spirit, evolution having originally begun from above and proceeding downwards instead of the reverse, as taught in the Darwinian theory. Note, volume 1, page 154. End of note. Therefore, the tendency spoken of by the eminent naturalist above quoted is one inherent in every atom. Only, were one to apply it to both sides of the evolution, the observations made would greatly interfere with the modern theory, which has now almost become Darwinian law. But in citing the passage from Agassiz's work with approval, it must not be understood that the occultists are making any concession to the theory, which derives man from the animal kingdom. The fact that in this round he preceded the mammalia is obviously not impugned by the consideration that the latter, mammalia, follow in the wake of man. Verse 25. How did the Manasa, the sons of wisdom, act? They rejected the self-born, the boneless. They are not ready. They spurned the first sweat-born. They are not quite ready. They would not enter the first egg-born. Notes. This is explained in the section which follows this series of stanzas in the allegory from the Puranas concerning Kandu, the holy sage, and Pramloka, the nymph, alleged to have hypnotized him. Read subsections 2, commentary after stanza 1. A suggestive allegory scientifically, as the drops of the perspiration which she exuded are the symbols of the spores of science, read info. A note on the eggborn. This will be explained as we proceed. This unwillingness to fashion men or create is symbolized in the Puranas by Daksha having to deal with his opponent Narada, the strife-making ascetic. End of note. To a theist or a Christian, this verse would suggest a rather theological idea, that of the fall of the angels through pride. In the secret doctrine, however, the reasons for the refusal to incarnate in half-ready physical bodies seem to be more connected with physiological than metaphysical reasons. Not all the organisms were sufficiently ready. The incarnating powers chose the ripest fruits and spurned the rest. Note, Veda verse 24, end of note. By a curious coincidence, when selecting a familiar name for the continent on which the first androgynes, the third root race, separated, the writer chose on geographical considerations that of Lemuria, invented by Mr. P. L. Sclater. It is only later that, reading Haeckel's Pedigree of Man, it was found that the German animalist had chosen the name for his late continent. He traces, properly enough, the scent of human evolution to Lemuria, but with a slight scientific variation. Speaking of it as that cradle of mankind, he pictures the gradual transformation of the anthropoid mammal into the primeval savage, double exclamation mark. Focht again holds that in America man sprang from a branch of the Platyrrhine apes, independently of the origination of the African and Asian rootstocks from the Old World Catharinians. Anthropologists are, as usual, at loggerheads on this question, as on many others. We shall examine this claim in the light of esoteric philosophy in stanza 8. Meanwhile, let us give a few moments of attention to the various consecutive modes of procreation according to the laws of evolution. Let us begin by the mode of reproduction of the later subraces of the third human race, by those who found themselves endowed with the sacred fire from the spark of high and then independent beings, who were the psychic and spiritual parents of man, as the lower Pitar Devata, the Pitris, were the progenitors of his physical body. That third and holy race consisted of men who, at the zenith, were described as towering giants of godly strength and beauty, and the depositaries of all the mysteries of heaven and earth. Have they likewise fallen, if, then, incarnation was the fall? Of this presently. The only thing now to be noted of these is that the chief gods and heroes of the fourth and fifth races, as of late antiquity, are the deified images of these men of the third. The days of their physiological purity and those of their so-called fall have equally survived in the hearts and memories of their descendants. Hence the dual nature shown in those gods, both virtue and sin, being exalted to their highest degree in the biographies composed by posterity. They were the pre-Adamite and the divine races with which even theology, in whose sight they are all the accursed Cainite races, now begins to busy itself. But the action of spiritual progenitors of that race has first to be disposed of. A very difficult and abstruse point has to be explained with regard to stanzas 26 and 27. These say, 26, when the sweat-born produced the egg-born, the twofold, androgyne third race, the mighty, the powerful with bones, the lords of wisdom, said, now shall we create. Why now and not earlier? This the following sloka explains. 27. Then the third race became the vahan, vehicle, of the lords of wisdom. It created sons of will and yoga, bakriya shakti. It created them, the holy fathers, ancestors of the arhats. Note on the androgyne third race. The evolutionist Professor Schmidt alludes to the fact of the separation of sexes as to the derivation of which from species, once hermaphrodite, all the believers in creation naturally accepted, are assuredly of one accord. Such, indeed, is the incontestable evidence drawn from the presence of rudimentary organs. Compare his Doctrine of Descent and Darwinism, page 159. Apart from such palpable traces of a primeval hermaphroditism, the fact may be noted that, as Lange writes, a study of embryology shows that in the human higher animal species, the distinction of sex is not developed until a considerable progress had been made in the growth of the embryo. See Modern Zoroastrian, page 106. The law of retardation, operative alike in the case of human races, animal species, etc., when a higher type has once been evolved, still preserves hermaphroditism as the reproductive method of the majority of plants and many lower animals. End of note. When the Lords of Wisdom said, now shall we create? How did they create, since the Lords of Wisdom are identical with the Hindu devas who refused to create? Clearly, they are the Kumaras of the Hindu pantheon and Puranas, whose elder sons of Brahma, Sanandana, and the other sons of Vedhas, who previously created by him without desire or passion, remained chaste, full of holy wisdom, and undesirous of progeny. Note, see Vishnu Purana, Book 1, Chapter 7, Part 1. The power by which they first created is just that which has since caused them to be degraded from the high status to the position of evil spirits, of Satan and his host, created in their turn by the unclean fancy of exoteric creeds. It was by Kriya Shakti, that mysterious and divine power latent in the will of every man, and which, if not called to life, quickened and developed by yogi training, remains dormant in
999,999 men out of a million,
and gets atrophied. This power is explained in the 12 signs of the zodiac as follows. See also 5 Years of Theosophy, page 777. Kriya Shakti, the mysterious power of thought, which enables it to produce external, perceptible phenomenal results by its own inherent energy. The ancients held that any idea will manifest itself externally if one's attention and will is deeply concentrated upon it. Similarly, in an intense volition will be followed by the desired result. A yogi generally performs his wonders by means of Ichha Shakti, willpower, and Kriya Shakti. The third race had thus created the so-called sons of will and yoga, or the ancestors, their spiritual forefathers, of all the subsequent and present arahats, or mahatmas, in a truly immaculate way. They were indeed created, not begotten, as were their brethren of the fourth race, who were generated sexually after the separation of sexes, the fall of man. For creation is but the result of will acting on phenomenal matter, the calling forth out of it the primordial divine light and eternal life. They were the holy seed grain of the future saviors of humanity. Here we have to make again a break in order to explain certain difficult points, of which there are so many. It is almost impossible to avoid such interruptions. For explanations and a philosophical account of the nature of those beings, we are now viewed as the evil and rebellious spirits, the creators by Kriya Shakti. The reader is referred to the chapters on the fallen angels and the mystic dragons in part 2 of this volume. The order of the evolution of the human races stands thus in the 5th book of the commentaries and was already given. The first men were Chayas. 1. The second, the sweatborn. 2. The third, eggborn, and the holy fathers born by the powers of Kriya Shakti. 3. The fourth were the children of Padmapani, Kenrisi. 4. Of course, such primeval modes of procreation, by the evolution of one's image, through drops of perspiration, after that by yoga, and then by what people regard as magic, Kriya Shakti, are doomed beforehand to be regarded as fairy tales. Nevertheless, beginning with the first and ending with the last, there is really nothing miraculous in them, nor anything which could not be shown natural. This must be proven. 1. Chaya birth, or that primeval mode of sexless procreation, the first race having oozed out, so to say, from the bodies of the Pitris, is hinted at in a cosmic allegory in the Puranas. See Vishnu Purana, Book 3, Chapter 2. It is the beautiful allegory and story of Sanina, the daughter of Vishvakarman, married to the sun, unable to endure the fervors of her lord, gave him her chaya, shadow, image, or astral body, while she herself repaired to the jungle to perform religious devotions, or tapas. The sun, supposing the chaya to be his wife, begat by her children, like Adam with Lilith, an ethereal shadow also, as in the legend, though an actual living female monster millions of years ago. But perhaps this instance proves little except the exuberant fancy of the Puranic authors. We have another proof ready. If the materialized forms, which are sometimes seen oozing out of the bodies of certain mediums, could, instead of vanishing, be fixed and made solid, the creation of the first race would become quite comprehensible. This kind of procreation cannot fail to be suggestive to the student. Neither the mystery nor the impossibility of such a mode is certainly any greater, while it is far more comprehensible to the mind of the true metaphysical thinker, than the mystery of the conception of the fetus, its gestation and birth as a child as we now know it. Now to the curious and little understood corroboration in the Puranas about the sweatborn. 2. Kandu is a sage and a yogi, eminent in holy wisdom and pious austerities, which finally awaken the jealousy of the gods who are represented in the Hindu scriptures as being in never-ending strife with the ascetics.
Indra, the king of the gods, finally sends one of his female apsarasas to tempt the sage. Note, in the oldest manuscript of Vishnu Purana in the possession of an initiate in southern India, the god is not Indra but Kama, the god of love and desire. See text further on. End of note. This is no worse than Jehovah sending Sarah, Abraham's wife, to tempt Pharaoh. But in truth, it is those gods and God who are ever trying to disturb ascetics and thus make them lose the fruit of their austerities who ought to be regarded as tempting demons, instead of applying the term to the Rudras, Kumalas, and Asuras, whose great sanctity and chastity seem a standing reproach to the Dungeonic gods of the pantheon. But it is the reverse that we find in all the Puranic allegories, and not without good esoteric reason. The king of the gods, or Indra, sends a beautiful apsarasas, nymph, named Pramloka, to seduce Kandu and disturb his penance. She succeeds in her unholy purpose, and 907 years, 6 months, and 3 days spent in her company seem to the sage as one day. Note, these are the exoteric figures given in a purposely reversed and distorted way, being the figure of the duration of the cycle between the first and second human race. All Orientalists, to the contrary, there is not a word in any of the Puranas that has not a special esoteric meaning. End of note. When this psychological or hypnotic state ends, the Muni curses bitterly the creature who seduced him, thus disturbing his devotions. "Depart, begone," he cries, "vile bundle of illusions." And Pramloka, terrified, flies away, wiping the perspiration from her body with the leaves of the trees as she passes through the air. She went from tree to tree, and as with the dusky shoots that crowned their summits, she dried her limbs, the child she had conceived by the Rishi came forth from the pores of her skin in drops of perspiration. The trees received the living dews, and the wind collected them into one mass. "This," said Soma, the moon, "I matured by my rays," and gradually it increased in size till the exhalation that had rested on the treetops became the lovely girl named Madisha. Note, Vishnu Purana, Book 1, Chapter 15. Compare also Vivian's Temptation of Merlin, Tennyson, the same legend in Irish tradition. End of note. Now Kandu stands here for the first race. He is a son of the Pitris, hence one devoid of mind, which is hinted at by his being unable to discern a period of nearly 1,000 years from one day. Therefore he is shown to be so easily deluded and blinded. He is a variant of the allegory in Genesis of Adam, born an image of clay into which the Lord God breathes the breath of life, but not of intellect and discrimination, which are developed only after he has tasted of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, in other words, when he has acquired the first development of mind and had implanted in him manas, whose terrestrial aspect is of the earth earthy, though its highest faculty is connected with the spirit and the divine soul. Pramloka is the Hindu Lilith of the Aryan Adam, and Marisha, the daughter born of perspiration from her pores, is the sweat-born and stands as a symbol for the second race of mankind. As remarked in the footnote, Vida Super, it is not Indra who now figures in the Puranas, but Kamadeva, the god of love and desire, who sends Pramloka on earth. Logic, besides the esoteric doctrine, shows that it must be so, for Kama is the king and the lord of the apsarasas, of whom Pramloka is one, and therefore when Kandu, in cursing her, exclaims, "Thou hast performed the office assigned by the monarch of the gods, go!" he must mean by that monarch Kama and not Indra, to whom the apsarasas are not subservient. For Kama again is in the Rig Veda 10:129, the personification of that feeling which leads and propels to creation. He was the first movement that stirred the One, after its manifestation from the purely abstract principle, to create. Quote, "Desire first arose in it, which was the primal germ of mind, and which sages, searching with their intellect, have discovered to be the bond which connects entity with non-entity." Unquote. A hymn in the Athavara Veda exalts Kama into a supreme god and creator and says, "Kama was born the first, him neither gods nor fathers, Pitara nor men have equaled." A hymn in the Atharva Veda
exalts Karma into a supreme god and creator, and says, Karma was born the first. Him neither gods nor fathers, Pitara, nor men have equaled. Unquote. The Atharva Veda identifies him with Agni, but makes him superior to that god. The Taittiriya Brahmana makes him allegorically the son of Dharma, moral, religious duty, piety and justice, and of Shraddha, faith. Elsewhere, Karma is born from the heart of Brahma. Therefore, he is Atmabhu, self-existent, and Aja, the unborn. His sending Pramloka has a deep philosophical meaning sent by Indra. The narrative has none. As Eros was connected in early Greek mythology with the world's creation and only afterwards became the sexual Cupid, so was Karma in his original Vedic character, Harivansa making him a son of Lakshmi, who is Venus. The allegory, as said, shows the psychic element developing the physiological before the birth of Daksha, the progenitor of real physical men, made to be born from Marisha, and before whose time living beings and men were procreated by the will, by sight, by touch, and by yoga, as will be shown. This, then, is the allegory built on the mode of procreation of the second of the sweatborn, the same for the third race in its final development. Marisha, through the exertions of Soma, the moon, is taken to wife by the Praketasas, the production of the mind-born sons of Brahma also, from whom they beget the patriarch Daksha, a son of Brahma also, in a former kalpa or life, explain and add the Puranas in order to mislead, yet speaking the truth. Note, the text has, from Brahma were born mind-engendered progeny, with forms and faculties derived from his corporeal nature, embodied spirits produced from the limbs, gatra, of Dhimat, all-wise deity. These beings were the abode of the three qualities of Devasarga, divine creation, which, as the fivefold creation, is devoid of clearness of perception, without reflection, dull of nature. But as they did not multiply themselves, Brahma created other mind-born sons like himself, namely the Brahmarishis, or the Prajapati, 10 and 7. Sanandana and the other sons of Vedas, Brahma, were previously created, but as shown elsewhere, they were without desire or passion, inspired with holy wisdom, estranged from the universe and undesirous of progeny. Book 1, Chapter 7. These Sanandana and other Kumaras are then the gods who, after refusing to create progeny, are forced to incarnate in senseless men. The reader must pardon unavoidable repetitions in view of the great number of the facts given. End of note. 3. The early third race, then, is formed from drops of, quote, sweat, unquote, which, after many transformations, grow into human bodies. This is not more difficult to imagine or realize than the growth of the fetus from an imperceptible germ, and then into a strong, heavy man. But this race again changes its mode of procreation according to the commentaries. It is said to have emanated a viformativa, which changed the drops of perspiration into greater drops, which grew, expanded, and then became ovoid bodies, huge eggs. In these, the human fetus gestated for several years. In the Puranas, Marisha, the daughter of Kandu, the sage, becomes the wife of the Praketasas and the mother of Daksha. Now Daksha is the father of the first human-like progenitors, having been born in this way. He is mentioned later on. The evolution of man, the microcosm, is analogous to that of the universe, the macrocosm. His evolution stands between that of the latter and that of the animal for which man, in his turn, is a macrocosm. Then the race becomes, 4, the androgyne or hermaphrodite. This process of men-bearing explains, perhaps, why Aristophanes describes the nature of the old race as androgynous, the form of every individual being rounded, having the back and sides as in a circle, whose manner of running was circular, terrible in the force and strength, and with prodigious ambition, see Plato's Banquet. Therefore, to make them weaker, Zeus divided them in the third root race into two, and Apollo, the sun, under his direction, closed up the skin. The Madagascans, the island belonged to Lemuria, have a tradition about the first man who lived at first without eating, and, having indulged in food, a swelling appeared in his leg. This bursting, there emerged from it a female,
who became the mother of their race. Truly, we have our sciences of heterogenesis and parthenogenesis showing that the field is yet open. The polyps produce their offspring from themselves, like the buds and ramifications of a tree. Why not the primitive human polyp? The very interesting polyp Steridium passes alternately from a gemmation into the sex method of reproduction. Curiously enough, though it grows merely as a polyp on a stalk, it produces gemmules, which ultimately develop into a sea nettle or medusa. The medusa is utterly dissimilar to its parent organism, the Steridium. It also reproduces itself differently by sexual method, and from the resulting eggs, Steridia once more put in an appearance. This striking fact may assist many to understand that a form may be evolved, as in the sexual Lemurians, from hermaphrodite parentage, quite unlike its immediate progenitors. It is, moreover, unquestionable that in the case of human incarnations, the law of karma, racial or individual, overrides the subordinate tendencies of heredity, its servant. The meaning of the last sentence in the above-quoted commentary on stanza 27, namely that the fourth rays were the children of Padmapani, may find its explanation in a certain letter from the inspirer of esoteric Buddhism quoted on page 68. The majority of mankind belongs to the seventh sub-race of the fourth root race, the above-mentioned Chinamen and their offshoots and branchlets, Malayans, Mongolians, Tibetans, Hungarians, Finns, and even the Eskimo, are all remnants of this last offshoot. Padmapani, or Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit, is in Tibetan Kyenresi. Now, Avalokiteshvara is the great logos in its higher aspect, and in the divine regions. But in the manifested planes he is, like Daksha, the progenitor in the spiritual sense of men. Padmapani Avalokiteshvara is called esoterically a bodhisattva, or Dhyankocham, Kenresi Vankug, the powerful and all-seeing. He is considered now as the greatest protector of Asia in general, and of Tibet in particular. In order to guide the Tibetans and Lamas in holiness, and preserve the great arhats in the world, this heavenly being is credited with manifesting himself from age to age in human form. A popular legend has it that whenever faith begins to die out in the world, Padmapani Kenresi, the lotus-bearer, emits a brilliant ray of light and forthwith incarnates himself in one of the two great lamas, the Dalai and Tesku lamas. Finally, it is believed that he will incarnate as the most perfect Buddha in Tibet instead of in India, where his predecessors, the great rishis and manas, had appeared in the beginning of our race, but now appear no longer. Even the exoteric appearance of Dioni Kenresi is suggestive of esoteric teaching. He is evidently, like Daksha, the synthesis of all the preceding races, and the progenitor of all the human races after the first complete one, and thus is represented as the culmination of the four primeval races in his 11-faced form. It is a column built in four rows, each series having three faces or heads of different complexions, the three faces for each race being typical of its three fundamental physiological transformations. The first is white, moon-colored, the second is yellow, the third red-brown, the fourth, in which are only two faces, the third face being left a blank, a reference to the untimely end of the Atlanteans, is brown-black. Padmapani, Daksha, is seated on the column and forms the apex. In this reference, compare stanza 39. The Dhyankocham is represented with four arms, another allusion to the four races. For while two are folded, the third hand holds a lotus, Padmapani, the lotus-bearer, this flower symbolizing generation, and the fourth holds a serpent, emblem of the wisdom in his power. On his neck is a rosary, and on his head the sign of water, matter, deluge, while on his brow rests the third eye, Shiva's eye, that of spiritual insight. His name is Protector of Tibet, Savior of Humanity. On other occasions, when he has only two arms, he is Kenresi, the Dhyani and Bodhisattva. Kakma Padma Karpu, he who holds a lotus. His other name is Kantong, he of the thousand eyes, when he is endowed with 1,000 arms and hands, on the palm of each of which is represented an eye of wisdom, these arms radiating from his body like a forest of rays. Another of his names is Lokapati and Lokanata, in Sanskrit, Lord of the World, and Jigtengonpo in Tibetan, Protector and Savior against evil of any kind. Padmapani, however, is the lotus-bearer symbolically only for the profane. Esoterically, it means the supporter of the kalpas, the last of which, the present Mahakalpa, the Varaha, is called Padma, and represents one half of the life of Brahma. Though a minor kalpa, it is called Maha, great, because it comprises the age in which Brahma sprang from a lotus. Theoretically, the kalpas are infinite, but practically, they are divided and subdivided in space and time, each division, down to the smallest, having its own dhyani as patron or regent. Padmapani, Avalokiteshvara, becomes in China, in his female aspect, Kuan Yin, who assumes any form at pleasure in order to save mankind. The knowledge of the astrological aspect of the constellations on the respective, quote, birth days, unquote, of these dhyanis, Amitabha, the Umitufu of China included, for example, on the 19th day of the 2nd month, on the 17th day of the 11th month, and on the 7th day of the 3rd month, etc., etc., gives the occultist the greatest facilities for performing what are called magic feats. The future of an individual is seen, with all its coming events marshaled in order, in a magic mirror placed under a ray of certain constellations.
But beware of the reverse of the medal. Sorcery. Next chapter is Stanza 8, Evolution of the Animal Mammalians, the First Fall.
Curiously.